Reset the podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Today I chat to Jeff McDonald, perhaps one of the most passionate campaigners globally for mental health and well-being. Jeff's story is not of one personal reset, but two. As a result of mental health illness and the loss of one of his closest friends through suicide, Jeff reset his professional life to dedicate it to the well-being cause. During our conversation, he talks very powerfully about why his closest friend's death affected him so much. We also chat about his drive to ensure that workplaces everywhere spend as much time creating mental and emotional safety as they do physical safety. And Jeff's most powerful observation about why well-being matters quite so much, because the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. A phrase which is a powerful reminder to us all that you never really know how someone is feeling inside. There's a trigger warning in today's podcast. It covers a conversation about suicide. If you've been personally impacted by the topic spoken about in this podcast and would like further help or support, please do call the Samaritans on telephone number 116 123 in the UK or a similar company or workplace environment close to you. Thank you. Jeff, so lovely to see you today, sitting in your garden.
Yeah, you know, I've been so lucky this year, Suki. You know that I had 5 months in South Africa from December through until May. So I had a wonderful summer. And now I've come back to the UK and I've got another summer. So it's so cool.
Yeah, and I know how much you love being outside in the sunshine. You're just, you know, you're South African, but you're somebody who just loves the outdoors, aren't you?
Yeah, I just love it. Yeah, and it's so nice and green now, and the colours. I was out on my mountain bike this morning, and you know, this country at this time of the year, you can't beat it. The different colours of greens, the blueness of the sky, the rolling hills—it's just glorious.
Yeah. I know, and I feel so lucky that I'm still on the beach for most of the time down in Cornwall, and it just makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Huge.
We are lucky. Look, this is a very special podcast for me because look, you and I, we work together. We share the same passion about putting well-being right at the heart of the business. But I want to kind of cover two things today. I want to cover some of that passion, what you're doing, how we're working together, and some of the principles for anyone who's looking at how do they make well-being a strategic priority. But also, as always on this Reset the podcast, I want to share and understand a little bit about your personal journey, what you've been through, how you've reset your life really significantly and perhaps more than many in the past few years. So maybe let's start at that place, because Jeff, you were you had a very senior HR role at Unilever, working with, amongst others, Keith Weed. You're a very successful businessman, you're a South African, you must have been kind of the top of your game. And then something really difficult happened for you, didn't it?
Yeah, Suki, it's amazing. You know, it's almost, 2008 is when it really all started, I suppose. You know, Keith was running the home care business for Unilever globally, Keith Weed. I was his HR business partner back in 2008, and one evening, 25th of Jan, never forget the date, because the 26th of Jan, my daughter was going to turn 13, and we were all so excited about her 13th birthday. And around about midnight, I get woken up with a massive panic attack. And, you know, that was, I suppose, the last straw to break the camel's back, because by midday the following day, I'm in a doctor's rooms and I am diagnosed with anxiety-fueled depression. And, wow. You know, me, depression? I often say, you know, my understanding of the word depression up until that point was probably, I'm an Arsenal supporter. You know, I love Arsenal Football Club. Well,
yeah, someone has to,
exactly. But just try and be an Arsenal supporter. And, you know, in the days of Wenger, it took 2/3 before the wheels fell off of the season. And I would turn to my wife and say, I'm depressed. And she'd say, why, Jeff? And I'd say, of this Arsenal football team. With Arteta now, it takes 1/3 of the season and the wheels fall off. And I, you know, and that was kind of my understanding of the word depression. I remember when Unilever first moved me to the UK in 98. I don't know, about 2 years later, people used to talk to me around January time of a thing called SAD, seasonal affect disorder. And I used to think to them, what's that? And they would say, no, it's the weather. It can influence your mood. And I remember, Suki, I remember thinking, what a load of crap. The weather. Come on, just man up, you snowflake. You know, I mean, this was me, my understanding of this whole concept of depression. And here I am on my daughter's 13th birthday, diagnosed with anxiety-filled depression.
And when you woke up in the middle of the night, Debbie's your wife, what did you say? Because I've spoken to lots of people who've had that kind of moment of an anxiety attack, and they think they're having a heart attack. Did you think that you were going to die, or what did you think was happening?
Yeah, you know, I mean, number one, the words panic attack were never part of my vocabulary. I had never had a conversation with anybody about a panic attack. I don't think so. I had no experience of this thing. And, you know, the ends of my fingers are tingling. The ends of my toes are tingling. The bed sheets are wet with sweat because I must have been sweating profusely in the lead up to this. And I get woken up with my heart beating profusely, struggling to regulate my breathing. And yes, you know, I bump Debbie and I say, I'm about to have a heart attack. I think this is a heart attack. And she says, why? And I try to explain all of those things that I'm feeling. And then she said, look, why don't you just get up, walk around the room, take some deep breaths, which I did. And that really helped. You know, it helped to lower the levels of anxiety by just getting up and taking these deep breaths. And slowly, slowly, those levels of anxiety began to subside. Got back into bed, but I couldn't go back to sleep. You know, struggled to go back to sleep because I was fearful it would happen again. The adrenaline is pumping through my body. I start catastrophizing over all sorts of things, these sort of, you know, making mountains out of molehills in terms of some of my thoughts.
And we'll come on and talk about what happened next, but I'm fascinated. Can you look back now and go, that's what led to this? Because, you know, you and I now, we work with lots of very high performing teams. Unilever is a lovely culture in many ways. It's a high performance culture. We see people, we talk about, you know, kind of people getting to that moment where maybe they don't even know that they're getting close to burnout. Can you understand what was happening and how you got to that place?
And only if I reflect on it now, you know, if I reflect on what was going on in my life at the time. You know, you and I, we were doing a session with an organization the other day, weren't we? And you know, we were talking about leaders. And, you know, I always say that, you know, if you're going to lead for the well-being of your people, you've got to care for your own well-being and your own health. Because you can't care for anybody's health and well-being if you don't care for your own. And I remember, you know, that we were talking about, you know, leaders kind of thinking that they're invincible. Yes. They're just invincible. And I suppose I was a bit like that. Do you know what I mean? I kind of thought I was invincible. But when you reflect back, you know, at the time, first of all, I was 20 years into a career with Unilever. Most of that I'd been an expatriate all over the world. And now we were suddenly being told by Unilever, look, you can no longer be on the expat gravy train. You need to localize. And over that time, I'd saved a fair amount of money. Mm. And it felt very secure. That money was in the bank. It was there. And now suddenly I'm being told, okay, look, you're probably going to have to make roots here in the UK. I have to take that money out of the bank. I'm going to have to go and buy a house. I'm going to have to create a sense of identity about living here and not going back to South Africa, the home, you know, the place that I love. You know, there were a few things going on with the kids at the time. The job was quite stressful, you know, work for Weed. Yeah. I mean, he's quite a demanding individual.
Yeah, he's quite demanding, he is,
you know, work for him, you know. And so there were the stresses and the strains of the job. There was a particular conference we were organizing. Things weren't going well. I mean, there was just a whole, so much crap being thrown at me at just that one time. And I was living my life on adrenaline. I thought I was invincible. I thought I could just keep going. I didn't need to recover. I could work long hours. I could be on aeroplanes all the time. Well, guess what? I broke.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So you went to the doctor, and what did the doctor say? How did you then get better?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm so lucky that I was so lucky I had the panic attack, I think, because, you know, that forced me, you know, coming back to your question as well. I mean, I don't think, up until that point, I don't think I was that self-aware of my feelings and what was going on inside me. And I was just thinking I was feeling a little bit stressed. But I was quite lucky because the panic attack was very much the last straw to break the camel's back, which meant I had to go and see I went to see a doctor, and the doctor gives me this diagnosis of anxiety-fueled depression, you know. And he doesn't do any physical examination, you know, he just talks about, you know, what had happened to my diet over a period of time, how I'd lost so much weight, how I wasn't sleeping really well, how I wasn't wanting to do the things that I normally enjoy doing, wasn't looking forward to holidays, I wasn't looking forward to anything. I couldn't read a newspaper because anything negative or sad would just trigger me. And you know, he gives me this diagnosis. And, you know, Suki, I think in many ways, getting the diagnosis was the first step in my recovery, because it liberated me to be able to feel that I could talk to people about what was wrong with me. Whereas up until that point, I didn't know what was going on. But having the diagnosis in many ways liberated me. And it allowed me to begin to have conversations with my family, with some of my colleagues at work, with my friends. I had to take 3 months off work. And you've heard me say it before, you know, that was the life-saving moment, because my ability to talk meant that I got, from all the people who knew about my illness, I got the most wonderful outpouring of the most powerful emotion in the world. Jennifer Rush, the power of love.
It's called love. I love it. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I had dark moments, Suki. I had dark, dark moments over those 3 months, moments when I didn't think life was worth living. And I think just knowing that I was loved by a 10-year-old, by Keith at the time, because he was my boss, I felt that sense of love. And I also used to meet with a guy who 2 years prior to my illness had been so sick that he'd been admitted to the Priory. And I was never that ill. And he was a colleague of mine. And I saw he was better and he gave me hope. And so I think it was a combination of love, a sense of hope, and then, yes, some of the traditional stuff around cognitive behavioral therapy, some medication, slowly getting back onto my bicycle. And by the way, those things worked for me. They don't necessarily work for everybody else. But I think having, you know, just feeling loved and that sense of hope were so instrumental in helping me to recover. And I think the final thing I would say is, and I mean, you know, I don't drink alcohol. I've been a teetotaler all my life. But we always hear that alcoholics only get better when they recognize that they're an alcoholic. And for me, recognizing and accepting that I was a depressive and I needed to get myself better was the beginning of the journey of recovery, and being able to ask for that help and go and get the help and have the conversations that made me feel loved and gave me a sense of hope, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
Those were critical ingredients in my recovery.
I can see that. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I've heard you do talk about love, and in the workplace, it kind of does make people go a bit, oh, he's talking about love in the workplace. We don't love people we work with. We love our family. We love our friends. So it always, and I love, you know, I love the fact that people kind of take a bit of a sharp intake of breath at that. And I so empathize. When I had cancer first time 12 years ago, outpouring of love was extraordinary. And, you know, absolutely from people in the industry, some people else, some people I hardly knew at all, was an amazing part of my recovery. And I think equally in a very different way, that does give you a very different perspective and it makes you reappraise your life. When you went back to the doctor and you got this diagnosis, did Debbie say, oh yes, I knew there was something wrong, this is how I've seen you behave,
No, it was a shock. I think it was a real shock. It was a shock to everybody. I mean, Jeff McDonald, depression, you know, often there's that lovely saying, and I'm not saying I'm this, but Carl Jung, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. The brighter the light, the darker the shadow. And there are so many examples of it. And there are so many examples out there of people who have come out and spoken about their struggles with anxiety and depression, who you would never, ever have thought. I mean, look at this young girl now in the French Open, Osaka.
Yes.
I mean, look at it. It's so topical right now. Here is this amazing, you know, she's the second best women's tennis player in the world. And she struggles. Yeah. So sometimes we just, you know, and for Debbie, this was a complete shock. I mean, I didn't have the profile or the stereotype or whatever about, you know, what's the stereotype around people who suffer from depression and anxiety? They're weak. You know, they can't take the heat in the kitchen. That's the stereotype. So for her, it was a real shock. I mean, but for Anna, the 10-year-old, I remember Anna saying to me when I came home and told them what was going on. I mean, she didn't really understand this. She's 10. But she did say to me, she said, you know what, Dad? I've noticed your batteries have been flat over the last 3 weeks. You know, this little 10-year-old, that's the way she kind of, I noticed your batteries have been flat. But for Debbie, no, it was a shock. It was a real shock.
Gosh. And then you did get better. I know you had another time when it came back and, you know, you were struggling a bit. But, you know, things were then good at Unilever. You'd, you know, probably changed life a little bit. But that wasn't what then made you leave and go on to doing the work you're doing now. Something else then happened. What was that, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll never forget it. You know, the 12th of October, 2012 or so, and I was leaving the office one evening and walking over the bridge, Blackfriars Bridge, phone goes, it's Debbie on the end of the phone. And she said, I've got terrible, terrible news. And I said, you know, what is it? And she said, one of your closest friends died by suicide this afternoon. And, you know, Suki, he was the epitome of the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. I mean, here was a, yes, he was alpha male, Afrikaner, South African. And he brought so much energy, passion, love, and light to the world. And now he was gone. And not one of his friends had picked up that he was struggling emotionally and mentally. Not one, because he was so good at masking it. He couldn't even talk to me about his emotions and how he was feeling. And instead, he died by suicide. And you know, that night I lay in bed and I came to the simplest of conclusions. And I just thought, what's the difference between him and me? And I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a therapist. I mean, I'm not an expert in mental health either. I mean, I'm just somebody with lived experience who's trying to bring some good to the world as a result of that experience. And I thought, here I am in 2012, 4 years after my crucible moment, flourishing in many ways, flourishing and maintaining my recovery, because I know I'm susceptible to this thing, right? And so every single day I have to maintain my recovery and I have a regime and I have a habit of things that I do to maintain my recovery. And he's gone. What's the difference? And the simple conclusion I came to was I've been able to have that one conversation, that led me on a path to recovery, and he couldn't. Stigma had just killed my friend. And you know, Suki, that was the catalyst. I just thought, this is not fair. It's not fair that he couldn't talk. And I'm not saying for 1 minute, had he been able to talk, he would definitely be alive today. But what I am saying is there's a tiny chance. You're down in Cornwall, you're going to go and have a great surf after this podcast. You're going to walk on the sand and there are going to be grains of sand. Those are tiny, tiny. There's a tiny chance that he'd still be alive today if he'd been able to have a conversation. And that is worth fighting for. Together with you and the Reset team, it is worth fighting for every single day of our lives to just give people that tiny chance, which might lead to a recovery or a partial recovery rather than the tragic potential consequences of a suicide.
Yeah, and you're so right. I think for me, I still find it extraordinary that this stigma still exists, because it does exist, doesn't it? And we see it almost every day in the work we do.
Yeah, it's huge. And look, I think it's in some ways, I don't know if you read the FT this morning, but and they're talking a lot about Osaka and her now pulling out of the French Open and how all of this could have been avoided. And one of the things they're saying is, you know, young people today are prepared to talk about this stuff. They are prepared to talk about it. And so I think it's very much, it's a generational thing. You know, it's people like you, our parents, their parents. No, you didn't talk about this stuff. And so I think the stigma, and for as long as our generation are leading organizations and workplaces still today, I think there's still a huge amount of stigma. But I've got so much hope. Because young people are going to lead those organizations into the future. And they've been prepared to talk about this stuff. They're just seeing it as just like a physical illness. And I'm so, so hopeful that into the future, you know, there will be less stigma.
Yes. Yes, and definitely less stigma. But also, and I think, look, we have seen in this last year, probably more than any other time, that well-being is absolutely come to the forefront of our minds. Yeah. I think we can yeah. see it. We can see people asking the right questions. We can see some really brilliant organizations beginning to take it seriously, spending some money, putting in programs. And I don't know about you, but I'm always fascinated. I found in every business that I've started that I always thought it would be the businesses that needed it most that would use us. And it's never the case at the beginning. It's always the businesses that are really good,
yes,
that do more.
Yes.
You know, so we're working with Google at the moment. You know, they're yes. amazing at this stuff, but they're like, do you know what? We're not good enough.
Yeah.
We need our people to perform better. We know that putting well-being as a strategic priority will make a difference. And I just find that extraordinary. And again, this afternoon, I've just been talking to a bank and they went, well, we've got 30 grand for all our people for the whole year in this well-being space. I'm like, you've got 650 people in this particular team. Really? Yeah. Really? Is that how important they are?
Yeah.
So what is it that enables an organization to really focus on well-being? What do they need to do?
Yeah, look, I mean, I really do think it starts with the CEO. It starts with the CEO and that executive team. It starts with their own sense and self-awareness and the importance they place around their health and their well-being as a critical driver of their performance. And understanding that, it's so, so important. And I think it really starts there. And you know, the more CEOs, the more CFOs who really, really value their own health, their own well-being. I mean, you look, Nike, the CEO of Nike. I mean, this is at the top of their agenda. The whole mental health and well-being. Why? Because it's an organization that sees the value in people being healthy and how health can then be a critical enabler and a driver of performance. I mean, when I was sick, I mean, I had all the skills, all the knowledge, all the experience, all the behaviors to do my job. 20 years, senior HR job in Unilever. You know what I didn't have, Suki? I didn't have my health. And so I couldn't perform. And so I think that's one of the things we've got to overcome and we've got to get better at in helping leaders to see, you know, it's coming back to our point about them thinking they're invincible. Well, we're not invincible. And then I think it is, you know, people like us, Reset, really helping them see that case, seeing the business case behind this, seeing this link between well-being, energy, and the performance of an organization and making that link. And then finally, you know, we've always been so good at creating safe workplaces, physically safe workplaces, right? And it's easier to do that. You know, if there's a box in the corridor, you teach people not to put the box in the corridor because somebody's going to, you know, and you are concerned about people's physical safety. You don't want them tripping over the box in the corridor. And I think where we've got to get to now is we've also got to have that same level of concern around the emotional and mental state of our people and show the same level of a commitment to keeping people safe, but not just physically, but also mentally and emotionally.
Yes, and that you're absolutely right, isn't it? Because we've seen companies spend millions of pounds on safety, but they hadn't quite got. I was talking to Stephen Pipross, the chairman of Mace recently, a big construction company.
I know. Brilliant,
and actually do quite a lot.
Big construction business, yeah.
Yeah, and Stephen and I were chatting and we were just kind of talking about the kind of things that they do. And I said, well, you know, do you do kind of nudges? Do you do those sort of things like you used to do? He said, what? So we used to do safety little films.
Yeah.
I said, have you ever done a well-being film at the beginning of a meeting?
Yeah.
No, I've never thought about it.
Yeah. Why not?
And you just go, it's so interesting. And he said, well, that's a great idea. We could definitely do that. And I think there's so much learning from safety that we can take into well-being in a different way. But for some reason, we haven't really done that yet, have we?
No. And look, I mean, you know, Suki, I mean, it is more complex, isn't it? You see the box, you move the box, all right? I mean, you know, the emotional and mental safety of people as part of the overall well-being, you know, that there's a number of factors that are contributing to that. There's the workplace, there could be stuff going on in people's lives, like a little bit like me, and it all makes it a little bit more complex. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't endeavor and want to learn and find out how best can we create a workplace where people are also emotionally and mentally safe and not just physically safe, you know? Yeah. And I think that's where we come into the picture as an organization like Reset, in being able to bring some of that expertise and that understanding. And I often think that a lot of these CFOs or CFOs or chief HR officers or whatever, I do believe the pandemic has opened this door and they've seen the benefits of caring for the well-being of their people, but they so often just don't know what to do, where to start, how do I begin this? What do I do? You know, and that's where I think that's where, you know, people like us come in to try and bring some of that expertise, that guidance, that challenge. Just like you did today. I think that was a wonderful challenge, you know, that, you know, talking to the chairman of Mace and throwing that challenge out. And, you know, it just makes people sit back and think, no, it makes absolute sense. Why wouldn't I want to do that?
Yes. I mean, I think the other thing that lots of companies, a challenge, and I get this challenge, is how much of it should be a business responsibility versus an individual responsibility. Because some of it is about empowering and enabling people to learn differently, to lead differently, to take responsibility themselves. And I know that's something that you are brilliant at talking about.
Yeah, I often say, Suki, you know, I often say a lot of these well-being programs, and let's say prior to the pandemic, because there has been some real, you know, the pandemic has been a bit of a silver lining around the well-being agenda. And we're beginning, as you said earlier on, right, you know, it's becoming more important in organizations. But I've often said that, you know, these well-being things never really stick. The CFO just rolls their eyes when you start talking about well-being. You know what I mean? Oh, here we go. Some fluffy. Well, you know what? The reason they don't stick is because I think there are three things that are missing. The first one is that organizations don't see it as a strategic priority. And, you know, Jim Collins often said in his book, Good to Great, he says, if you've got more than three strategic priorities, you've got no strategic priorities. And so how do you make sure that well-being is one of those three? And why? Well, the pandemic's just proved it to us. When people aren't healthy, look what happens to economies all over the world. Just look what happened. It's just decimated. So one, it's never a strategic priority. Secondly, there's no organization accountability to keep people healthy. There is to keep them safe, like you said earlier. Keep people safe, yes, but I don't feel any accountability to keep people healthy. And the third is there's no individual accountability. And I think it's a combination of both. I think we've got to create organizations. We've got to create ways of working in organizations. We've got to create an environment where people just want to thrive. And the organization must take responsibility for investing in resources, changing some of the ways of working, et cetera, shifting some of the leadership behaviors, recognizing the importance of compassion, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the organizational accountability. But then if an organization is prepared to have it as a strategic priority and therefore invest far more than 30,000, you know, whatever it was, 3,000, 30,000 for all their employees, because there's no ways. I mean, how much does it cost to put SAP into an organization, you know, a new IT system, which is going to integrate? I mean, it's going to cost hundreds of millions, all right? But if that organization is truly invested in this and has invested in the resources, shifted their ways of working, re-looked their leadership behaviors and what they expect of leaders, I then think, as an individual working for that organization, I have an accountability. There's a sense of obligation that I should use those resources. You know why? Because they'll make me feel more energized, more healthy, and I'll perform better. And I should be in some ways held accountable through a development conversation. Imagine a future fit planning conversation where we have I'm going to walk away, not just a skills development plan, but I'm also going to have a future fit plan.
Yeah.
You know, you, my boss, we've agreed a future fit plan over the next 6 months. Look what I'm going to do. I'm going to do these things to enhance the most important driver of my performance, my health.
Yeah. And you know, a future fit plan is such a simple idea. And it's extraordinary, isn't it, that it's not what we have within the business. And I think some of it is because people haven't really thought about it. But I think it feels like it's a real possibility now, isn't it?
I really do. I think it is. I think there are organizations that are seeing this as a real possibility. And, you know, some of the barriers have been, look, health is a personal thing. I mean, I shouldn't be talking to you about my health in an organization, or caring about your health, that's being paternalistic. You know, we as an organization are now being paternalistic about this. Well, guess what? We spent the last couple of years focusing on people's emotional mental health, teaching, you know, mental health first aiders, training everybody how to have these conversations. Oh, we want to be concerned about people's mental and emotional health, but why don't we also want to be concerned about their physical health and therefore have a more holistic, you know, conversation and around the well-being of people in organizations. And so this is not about being paternalistic. This is not about me, you know, wanting to interfere in your health, but it's about your performance in this organization. It's such a critical enabler of your performance. Also this kind of the sense of, you know, wanting to show that duty of care. And if we care for you physically, we also want to care for you emotionally and mentally. So this is not about being paternalistic. This is just about being an organization that is wanting to show a true duty of care to you as a human being, not just some physical production unit of production in an organization.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think for some leaders in particular, and we come back to that generational thing we talked about at the beginning, it's really hard. You know, and we do hear feedback of people saying, do you know what? I don't want to share how I feel. I don't think I need this in the workplace. Thank you very much. That's not my leadership style. And I think, and particularly some of those slightly more traditional organizations, there are people who love the kind of work and the change in focus and leadership skills. But there are also a lot of people who are going, do you know what? This is not for me. I don't want this conversation. I don't want this as a style of leadership. And I wonder whether that is something that we're increasingly seeing change, or whether those people will just disappear.
Well, I don't know. I see that change. I really do. And I think it's been brought about by the pandemic. I really do. Because I think, you know, you've heard me say this before, Suki, the pandemic has democratized the conversation around mental health and mental ill health. It's democratized it because there's not a single CEO, CFO, chief HR officer, senior leader, chairman, father, mother, daughter. There's none of us who has not been impacted psychologically by the pandemic. We've all been influenced by uncertainty, which drives anxiety, disruption to our social connections, which is not good for our mental and emotional health, changes in our family system, virtual working, all of this stuff. And so I think more and more, it's been okay to ask people, how are you feeling? And it's been more and more okay to say, I'm not really okay right now. And you know why? because of all the uncertainty that's going on. And my wish, Suki, is as we move through the bloody pandemic, as we move through that portal, that we take this level of compassion and this real humanness that's begun to show itself in organizations, that we take that through that portal. We leave all the other horrible stuff behind and we take that with us.
Yeah. And I think, go back to, that kind of idea of growth, we could see this is the moment, isn't it? It's the moment for businesses to change. It's the moment for real fast evolution to take place in a very different way of working, which I think would be extraordinary, wouldn't it? Absolutely.
Wow, wonderful. And I also think young people coming into organizations, you know what questions they're now asking? The really talented ones in the graduate schemes and all of this. One of the questions is, what are you going to be doing to care for my well-being? I want to know that before I accept this job. And if you haven't got something that feels bulletproof, that is real, then I'm going to look for an organization that has. Because you know what? I've seen what's happened to my father or my mother in, what your generation of working has done.
Yes. And I love that point, because I think, so many people at the moment going, I can't wait to get back to where we are. And of course, we're going to work in a hybrid way. Going, look, this is fine. If where we've come from was so brilliant, we should be going back to where we were before, but it's not. It's not. Why don't we use this as a moment to go, do you know what? Some of that was brilliant.
Yeah.
But we could work differently. We can see that there's a different way. And then just finally, Jeff, look, you do look after yourself. Your well-being, your mental, your physical well-being is really important. I love the stat that we used all the time is that there are 1,440 minutes in the day, and you want to take, and you do, 60 minutes of those for your, particularly your physical well-being. Tell us the kind of things that you do to look after yourself now.
Yeah, I want to leave all of our listeners with a little acronym, and it's called CANDO. CANDO. And I dedicate 60 to 90 minutes to the elements of that acronym every single day. And the C in CANDO stands for connection. So I'll take 10 minutes, I'll take 5 minutes, I might take 15 minutes to connect every single day with nature or with a friend or with a member of my family. True, true connection. Walk, leave my phone home, look at the leaves, look at the color of the greens right now. Connection, that's the C. The A is I'll be active every single day. That might be a 30-minute walk, it might be a jog. This morning it was out on the mountain bike, but I will find time to be active because it's so good for my physical health. The connection bit is so good for my emotional health. Connection is so good for our emotional health. The N in CANDO stands for just try and be nice to somebody every day. Just feel that you're giving rather than wanting to get all the time. It's a purposeful thing. It makes you feel a sense of purpose. I'm being nice to somebody. I'm giving. It just gives you that sense of purpose, that sense of meaning. That's the N. The D stands for discover, which is about being curious, learning something new. It's so good for your mental health. When you read something, you listen to a podcast, you learn a new skill, learn to play the guitar, whatever. It's just so good for our mental health. And I'll spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I'm listening to a fascinating podcast right now, So that's the D in discover, in CANDO. And the O, which is my biggest challenge, is take the foot off the accelerator and just every 2 hours, sit and observe. Just observe. And what do I mean by that? I mean, no phone, no laptop. Every 2 hours, take a 5-minute observation break. Stand and just observe and be absolutely in the present. Some people call it recovery. Just taking those 5 minutes every 2 hours to completely, completely recover. And I am hugely disciplined around CANDO and dedicating up to 60 to 90 minutes to those different elements of that little acronym. And then people say, as you say, they said to me, oh, Jack, where do you get 60 minutes from in a day? Where do you get 90 minutes? And you know the response. 1,440 minutes in a day. Can't you give yourself? And by the way, if 60 is too much of a mountain, then start with 15. Start with 10. Start with 20. Yeah. And just stick the oxygen mask on yourself first.
Yeah, absolutely. Stick that oxygen mask on yourself first. Look, Jeff, I love the fact that Anna all those years ago said that your batteries were just a little bit empty, and you are now such a fun, energetic, fueled person. I love your passion. I love working with you. I love what you have done to really raise not just well-being and mental health and the stigma, but actually linking it really tangibly with performance, because that's the way that businesses understand it, that it's going to make a difference. I think
Thank you, Suki. You
are so open and loving of everyone. And I'm really grateful that you are working with us, but I'm grateful that you are a kind of new friend of mine as well. So I can't wait to spend more time actually physically with you. But thank you for being on this journey with us, and thank you for talking to me today.
Yeah. And the feelings are mutual. So thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends, and family. Reset the podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.